Well, thank you very much indeed for the clap. I do hope you're still able to clap at the end. It is very daunting to speak to a crowd of your peers and colleagues, far more daunting than a first-year lecture or even than a seminar at another university, so I may be slightly nervous. Anyway, let's go on with something more interesting. You've probably all seen this. Nothing delights more than the image of a flickering candle. But at its most fundamental level, this is a chemical oxidation reaction, one in which a hydrogen-rich fuel is reduced to water. And in that sense, you have quite a lot in common with this flickering candle, because that's exactly how you generate most of your energy. You do it in a different way, and you conserve that energy in the form of a short-term chemical store that your cells can use, but the fundamental chemistry on which you're running is not really any different. So we're going to start with just a little bit of background to biological phenomena, for those who may not be so familiar with them. And I'm fishing in my pockets now for my glasses, because as you get later in life, you think you can read things, even when they're in Arial 15 font, but you can't. Anyway, of course, we wouldn't be anywhere without DNA, this magical and somewhat beautiful molecule, two anti-parallel strands of polynucleotides wrapped around each other, held in place by hydrogen bonds and van der Waals interaction between the adjacent bases. And it's this chemical information store on which all life depends. And this must have evolved, really, a very long time ago. We don't know exactly when. Whether RNA came first or DNA is a bit of a moot question. Some people think RNA, and that's a sort of controversial argument. But you can think of this, really, as the permanent information store of living cells. It's not immutable. It changes. It's subject to chemical degradation and attack. It's vulnerable to damage by free radicals. And, of course, it must change if it's to confer variation on which evolution can select the fittest. Or at least that's how Darwin put it. But DNA, of course, if you are going to use that information, you've got to move it. You've got to move that information out into the cell. And you do that with this molecule, a short-term information store. You might think of this as the program on the hard disk of the computer. This as the program running in the RAM of the computer, a temporary information store. Based again on nucleotides, a polynucleotide chain, but one that has been chemically modified to make it self-destruct. The presence of a 2' phosphate, a 2' hydroxyl on the ribose ring means that this doesn't last very long, is destroyed very quickly. So if you turn a gene on, it makes an RNA copy, that can be used to make protein, and as long as you turn the gene off, this will fade away and the signal will disappear. Of course, the main purpose of this information store is to make proteins, because at the end of the day, the proteins provide, if you like, the engine of the cell. They provide all the bits and pieces that you'd find under the bonnet, you know, the cylinders, the spark plugs, everything else. This is the business end that makes the cell work. And of course, this is what a eukaryotic cell might look like if you took it and sliced it in half, a nucleus, a very complex membranous system, a huge diversity of proteins. If this were a human cell, then in excess of 12,500 proteins, probably at least, to make that cell work and have the properties of a living organism. Many of these proteins, of course, are enzymes. They're biological catalysts whose role is to enhance the rate of chemical reactions, because most of what living systems do is, at its most fundamental level, chemistry. Very complex, very ordered, very directed chemistry, but it is nevertheless chemical in nature. What are proteins made of? Well, they're made from these basic 20 building blocks called amino acids. And they can be grouped according to their chemical properties. And we don't really know when these evolved or where they came about, but it's a very long time ago. Nor are they immutable. They've changed during the evolution of life. The pool of available amino acids has probably increased several times. And the problem is that these amino acids that make up proteins in themselves can't do all the chemistry that's necessary for life. That chemistry is very diverse, and it requires other things as well. For example, it requires inorganic metal ions. So if you take a living cell and you ask what metals does it contain, at the millimolar level we've got sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium, iron, zinc. As we get down to the 10 to the minus 15 molar, which for those of you who are not scientists is not a lot, you've got manganese, cobalt, zinc. Now, these have a special place because these are the sort of metal ions you need if you're going to do chemistry with oxygen. If you're going to manipulate oxygen in any way, you need a metal that can undergo a variable oxidation state change, one that's biologically available, and that living systems can take up and use. The last metal at the end here, selenium, that's so toxic and yet so necessary that the only way to control the dose is to genetically encode it. There is, in fact, a transfer RNA for selenium. It's actually genetically programmed so that you absolutely have to have the right amount. And, of course, metal ion balance is implicated now in many chronic disease states, such as central nervous system disease states, such as Menkin's disease, Wilson's disease, and even Alzheimer's and CJD and ALS. So if your metal ions get out of balance in your brain, there can be some serious implications for that. So with that introduction, where did life come from, and possibly where is it going? Well, if you went down to Brighton Beach about 4 billion years ago, you'd have got a bit of a shock, because the pier wouldn't be there, the deck chairs wouldn't be there. But more importantly, the sky would look sort of rather yellowy like this from the sulfur. There'd be a lot of hydrogen sulfide, methane, ammonia, carbon dioxide in the water. So if you went down for a breath of fresh air, well, it might be your last. This is just a hypothetical picture, really, but these funny little blocks that haven't come out very well are fossilized stromatolites, colonies of cyanobacteria, fossilized or siliconized and calcified fossils. And these are still present on the shores of Western Australia in Sharks Bay. So you can go and have a look at them if you like. And so these were among the earliest forms of life. They lived in this very different world where there was no oxygen. The redox potential, if you're a chemist, was round about that of NADPH, around about minus 340 millivolts. And oxygen was a trace contaminant, almost lethal to all the existing life forms at that time. And then as cyanobacteria eventually gave way to higher eukaryotes and photosynthesis began to take over, we see the first great oxygenation event. This would have been heralded at the time as probably the world's greatest pollution event, because oxygen at that time would have been absolutely lethal to all available organisms. Some of them survived, and we'll come on to how they managed to survive in a moment. A couple of billion years later, there's a second oxygenation event, and that seems to correspond to the point at which plants sort of struggled out of the oceans and made it to the land and began to photosynthesize effectively on land. And then finally, we're up to where we are today. From about 3% oxygen 2.2 billion years ago to about 21% now. Hasn't always been 21%. Around about the late Cenozoic, it dropped back to about 12% due to some sort of cataclysmic event, which we think may have finished off the dinosaurs. All those sulfides and everything welling out of the Earth's volcanic center used up a huge amount of oxygen, and it took many millions of years for that to be regressed by photosynthesis. So the Earth has constantly been changing, and it is only the way it is because life has made it that way. That's the important point, that the planet is the way it is because it's been transformed from this highly reducing, sulfurous place, the only sort of biblical analogy for that would be hell, up to this lovely, green, beautiful jewel that we live in today. And why is that? What are the biochemical milestones that underpin that tremendous change and transformation of the planet? Well, there's no doubt that early photosynthesis must have been one of the key biochemical events. In that highly reducing period, most life would have derived its energy from simple chemical reactions or from so-called chemolithotrophic growth. The same thing that's going on in the deep sea vents at the bottom of the Atlantic. Sulfides are welling up through volcanic springs, are a source of reducing power, and providing there's a source of oxidant, you can make some energy. And if you can trap sunlight through a photosystem based on chlorophyll, then you can make some energy that way as well. So providing there's a source of reducing power and a source of energy, or ATP, then you've got the ability to join simple organic molecules that may have been around in the sort of seawater soup at the time to make more complex ones. Then something happened around about a billion years ago, as we've seen, this second great oxygenation event kicked in. And we don't really know exactly when, but it was almost certainly connected with the development of photosystem II-like proteins. These are proteins that are able to split water. Presumably what happened is that the reducing power of the planet began to run down, or at least was only locally available. So living systems, in order to generate that reducing power to carry out biosynthesis, would have to access that from an alternative source. The only way they could do that was to make it locally, using energy from sunlight to split water, to generate oxygen as a byproduct, and reduced electrons, essentially hydride ions if you're a chemist, NADPH if you're a biochemist, and actually use that to power biosynthesis. And that's been going on now for a very long time. And that oxygen, of course, is what we have in the atmosphere today. The moment that oxygen levels rose, it enabled a nitrogen cycle to start. That oxidative power could be coupled to oxidize ammonia back through towards nitrogen. And nitrogen, being a terribly stable gas, tended to accumulate. But at that time, the advent of oxygen had a huge effect. Early anaerobic organisms simply couldn't cope. And they had to adapt, they had to develop strategies extremely rapidly for dealing with that oxygen. And as you know, most bacteria don't like oxygen even today. If you want to kill something, then bleach or active oxygen or antiseptic is a very good way of doing it. So oxidative respiration was extremely important. And the structure of this protein was only solved about 3 years ago. This is the incredibly complex structure of a respiratory oxidase, an enzyme that catalyzes the reduction of oxygen to water at the expense of low potential electrons. It also has the ability to pump protons across a membrane and indirectly generate chemical energy. And this functions really as the terminal end of a little electron transfer chain, which is embedded within this little organelle called the mitochondria, and electrons flow along this respiratory chain, probably at quite a high current, something like 2 to 3 amps at a voltage of something like 1 to 1.2 volts, something of that order. So you can do the maths on that. Each of these mitochondria can produce something of the order of 5 to 10 watts. It's quite a lot of power. So it's a little electrochemical battery, really, powered by oxygen reduction at the expense of hydrogen. It's a bit like a fuel cell, really. Of course, we only invented those about 10 years ago, but of course, nature had this a lot sooner than that. It's the biological equivalent of a fuel cell. The advent of molecular oxygen also meant a tremendous explosion in the available chemistry that you could do. Instead of just limited to reductive reactions, you've now got the full range of oxidative reactions available to you. At least 1,000 extra biochemical pathways must have began to evolve extremely quickly. Coupled with the confinement of respiration to an intracellular compartment, this produced a huge driving force for multicellularity and for more advanced eukaryotic development. The precise details of that are complex, and I'm ill-equipped to describe them to you. But one of them was actually the development or the production. With all this oxidative chemistry around, more oxygen around, you could now synthesize plant polymers as we know them today. Materials that have structural strength, are able to waterproof, and hence with these materials, plants could actually make it onto the land. Without them, they couldn't. And without oxygen, they couldn't make them. Do you begin to see how the linkage works? So all life on the planet became committed, really, to using oxygen at this point. Because if you didn't, you wouldn't last very long. You wouldn't have the energetic advantage, you wouldn't have the biosynthetic advantages that oxygen brings. But unfortunately, playing with oxygen or using oxygen is a dangerous thing. You do it at your peril. Because oxygen is rather easily reduced not just by 4 electrons to water, but also by 1 electron to something called superoxide anion here. You often see this in the press as a radical or dangerous radicals in the popular press. And that is a chemically spontaneous process that will occur whenever there is a reasonably low potential electron, single electron around from a donating group. And superoxide in itself isn't terribly dangerous, really. It can't cross membranes very well. It's highly charged. It's got a fairly long half-life, but it's not that chemically reactive. But if you reduce it by another electron, you get hydrogen peroxide. And hydrogen peroxide is dangerous. Chemists will know that a variety of disproportionation reactions involving superoxide all produce hydrogen peroxide, and that hydrogen peroxide itself, if it gets reduced by another electron, perhaps from a reduced ion or even a thiol or something like that, will produce hydroxyl radicals. And these are really the most dangerous thing in biology, because these have the ability to damage DNA. These will damage all the molecules of life, DNA, proteins alike. And while damaging proteins is not so bad, if you damage DNA, that's much more serious. And of course, the one advantage of that is that the advent of oxygen should have accelerated mutation rates, because that oxygen-based damage would have had an effect on mutation rates. So maybe variety would have had an initial advantage. But as organisms became more complex, they needed to be able to cope with this damage, because obviously more complex organisms are more likely to damage easily. So you have to control this, and living cells again do this by controlling the chemistry very carefully so that you go from here to here, but you do not go through these. You do not produce any of these. You go straight from there to there. You reduce oxygen with two concerted electron transfer events, that you go from there to there to there. And you don't go through any of these. So you need to control that chemistry extremely carefully. And that's what the oxidase complex does. And that's probably been one of the major driving forces for the evolution of that oxidase complex, that it must do this chemistry efficiently without poisoning the organism. So these radicals are almost certainly the reason we age. They're implicated in many of the genetic-based diseases that we suffer from, cancer, aging, and so forth. Because inevitably we can't stave off their effects completely. You can take your cabbage and green vegetables twice a day, you can take 5 pieces of fruit, you can dose yourself with a glass of Bordeaux red wine, you can take 75 milligrams of aspirin daily and you'll keep this down, and a heavy dose of perhaps 1 gram of vitamin C a day, but that's the best you can do. Beyond that, it's just between you, your genes, hydroxyl radicals, and your DNA repair systems. But Sussex has got the answer to that across the car park. So how do you control that chemistry? Well, very early on, living systems developed ways of doing that. This molecule was plagiarized, probably, from chlorophyll. It looks very like chlorophyll. It's a pyrrole, just like chlorophyll, but instead of a magnesium in the center, it has an iron. And this is called heme. And if you take that heme prosthetic group or pigment, embed it inside a protein, then you can control its chemistry much more successfully than if you just have this thing. And so living systems have particular combinations or particular specifications of heme protein that specialize in getting these oxygen reactions exactly right. So we have a terminal oxidase to do this sort of flame of life reaction, if you like, this terminal electron acceptor role. We have monooxygenases specialized in actually stereoselectively inserting that oxygen into a substrate. These are enzymes that, for example, are involved in degradation of xenobiotic metabolism, drug metabolism, the synthesis of androgens and estrogens, the sex hormones. So these enzymes are often involved in the synthesis of our second messenger systems. We also need a heme system to get rid of peroxide in case we produce it accidentally, and so that is the role of catalases. Plants have an additional role. They need to be able to make these waterproof polymers that are so essential, and they use enzymes called peroxidases and also some copper oxidases called lacases to do this job as well. So they use hydrogen peroxide, an aromatic compound, usually a phenol or a phenolic type compound, produce a radical. The radical polymerizes up to make those nasty waterproof cell walls. And so peroxidase is a very useful plant general polymerizing enzymes, I suppose. There's also a group of enzymes that don't occur very often, just in the odd fungus, now and again, and they actually use hydrogen peroxide to, again, stereoselectively insert an oxygen into the substrate. So they do the same thing, if you like, that a monooxygenase does, but instead of using oxygen, they use hydrogen peroxide. They're quite rare, don't occur very often at all. And the question is, if you're going to do this kind of thing, the peroxide basically has to be inside a vacuole or outside the cell. It's too dangerous to have it slopping around in the cytoplasm. So where do plant peroxidases fit into this? Well, what I'm going to try and do is just to show, to tell you a little bit about how peroxidases work, how they work by oxidizing substrates at the heme edge. Tell you a little bit about how you can engineer them to take on different properties, different catalytic properties. And then finally end up with a bit of a case study on perhaps an enzyme that's a bit more use, how we're trying to understand how lignin peroxidase is able to catalyze some very difficult chemistry, chemistry that an organic chemist would have to get the sledgehammer out for. But in fact, you can do this at pH 5 or 6 inside an enzyme. So let's have a look first at the properties of peroxidases. How do they work? Well, I'm going to use an example, which is one we've studied since 1990 on and off. It's called horseradish peroxidase. It's actually in ubiquitous use throughout, all over the world, because it's an enzyme enzyme diagnostic entity. It's in most of the world's AIDS kits. It's used as a reporter enzyme because it has the ability to turn over colored substrates extremely rapidly. It can produce electron-dense products. It can even emit light if you trick it with some clever free radical chemistry. So it's a simple, robust catalyst. You can purify it from plants very easily. It's got an established mechanism. It actually played a key part in our understanding of redox enzymes because it has some nice stable intermediates that are easy to trap and study. And so this is the high-resolution structure of horseradish peroxidase, solved in 1997 by Galgiel, Schuller, Henriksen. And it's a really beautiful little protein because it has this rather nice two-domain structure, if you like, nine alpha helices with a cavity in the center and the heme group sort of sandwiched between the two. You can actually chop this molecule in half, flip it over, and it almost fits the top half, leaving people to suppose that maybe it arose from some sort of early gene duplication event. But if you narrow in down on the cavity, this is the business end where all the chemistry goes on, and you look into that cavity, you see a lot more. You can see the side chains and the red side chains of the amino acids that make up the protein. And these are the things that control the chemistry of what's going on at the ion center. So we have a coordinate bond to a histidine here that controls the axial ligation of the ion. There's no ligand in the distal position because that has to be free to do chemistry. But up the top here, we have some residues that can be involved in acid-base catalysis and in stabilization of transition states. So this enzyme, as I said, played a historical role because if you add hydrogen peroxide to it, if you have one equivalent of enzyme and you add one equivalent of hydrogen peroxide, it forms this rather nice green thing called compound one. It has a very different sort of absorption spectra that's very, very characteristic. Then if you add one equivalent of substrate to it, it'll go back to this second intermediate called compound 2. That's green, and this is a little bit brownish. And if you add another mole of substrate, it'll even go back to the resting state in a very simple sort of triangular cycle. The iron is doing rather strange things in this catalytic cycle. The first hydrogen peroxide actually oxidizes it by two electrons so that it goes into a state that a chemist would call a ferrile state. The oxygen is in the plus four, the iron is in the plus four oxidation state, and one of the rest of the other electron has come out of the heme ring. So it's carrying an organic free radical on that heme, which doesn't really know where to go because it's a fully delocalized pi system, so it sort of wanders around the ring, not really knowing where to go. And if you add a substrate, all you do is replace that electron back onto the ring and the radical disappears. And then if you do the same again, you form water and the oxygen disappears. And we know a lot about how that reaction works because it's been possible through crystallographic studies, particularly by Poulos and colleagues, have worked out exactly how this enzyme works. And we tested their mechanism many years ago by taking out key elements of this acid-base machinery, and in particular taking out this arginine residue, which is responsible for polarizing the peroxide to oxygen bond. If you remove that, this is a rather nice intermediate here accumulates, and you can track the UV-visible spectrum of that species and prove that it is formed just before the compound 1. Why is this significant? Well, because all enzymes, or all iron enzymes that react directly with oxygen, essentially face the same problem and have to go through the same sort of compulsory intermediates. And so we were very anxious, or rather working in combination with Gunnar Berglund and Gunilla Carson and Janos Haidu at the BMC in Uppsala, we were very interested in trying to trap the structures of these intermediates. Now, they're reasonably stable, but they don't last more than a few minutes. And even if you can freeze them, make these intermediates, freeze the crystal, and then collect X-ray data in order to determine the structure, it's still a very difficult thing to do. And there's a big problem, because you have to put these crystals into a synchrotron and pass shoot X-rays at them for about 40 minutes in order to collect a full data set to solve the structure of the whole protein. And this funny graph here represents the X-rays being collected for 90 degrees of data collection. The problem is that when you do that and then you run the spectrum of the crystal, you get this, and then you look at the structure, you get this. You get something that is almost completely reduced. And therein lies a major problem in X-ray crystallography at synchrotrons, because in a sense, the X-rays are not totally invasive. They knock electrons out of the protein structure. Those electrons migrate to the vacant d orbitals of the iron, and the whole thing gets converted into a reduced state. It doesn't tell you anything. You start with an intermediate, you make an intermediate, put it in the X-ray beam, it's gone. So what Janos and Gunnar invented was a way of getting around that problem. What they did is we had these rather long crystals, monoclinic crystals, and if you shined the X-ray beam straight through here, whoops, wrong way, straight through here, and collected 90 degrees of data, that was fine. Then you rotated the crystal 10 degrees, collected another data set. So you offset it 10 degrees, collected another data set. Then moved along and burnt through a little bit further up the crystal, offset 20 degrees and did it again, offset 30 degrees and so on and so forth. So that by reconstituting a data set from this slice, you could obtain a crystal that had only ever seen about 11 degrees worth of X-ray exposure. So it really had not seen a high dose of X-rays. And if you repeated that process, you could actually reconstitute data sets that correspond to more and more reduction of the system in the crystal. So one of the advantages... if it's going to start or not. Whoops. So you can see now, you've got a big lobe. I'll wait for it to run all the way around, because otherwise it's going to be complicated. So we're just waiting for it to come to the end of its cycle here. So the enzyme is very nearly reduced now, and it's now in almost the fully reduced state. And a reduced crystal, if it's allowed to warm up and react with molecular oxygen, it will bind oxygen very, very strongly. And what we should get is this big lobe. This is dioxygen bound to the reduced state. A little more X-rays, the reduction process starts. We've got the oxyferrol intermediate, one water molecule on the way out. The oxyferrol is almost finally gone. You get the idea. You can actually see the reaction taking place in the crystal. So in a sense, this is a model for how oxidases work. It is essentially dioxygen, four electrons, four protons, and water out at the end, and the fully reduced enzyme, which if you warmed it up, the crystal ought to react with oxygen again and go around the cycle. So it is a sort of mimic of the oxidase reaction. But by using the same strategy, it became possible to actually trap the other intermediates directly. You could carefully mix a crystal with a little bit of hydrogen peroxide, get it to form that intermediate. And if you did the same trick and just reconstitute the data set for 8 degrees worth of data collection, you get a nice structure of the ferrol intermediate. You can measure the bond length and you can see exactly what's going on. And you can do a similar thing for compound 2, the second intermediate. You can see the bond length has just lengthened very slightly because the radical has gone. In reality, the structural changes are very, very slight. And what that actually means is that it's the electronic changes that you can't see that are the key to the properties of these intermediates. And of course, they don't show up in the structure. But what this shows is that there's very little structural change with respect to those intermediates. The key things are electronic in nature. And you can see that from the UV visible absorption spectra here for the crystal. This is leasing the optical signals from the crystal. And you can see again, this is compound one, and then we've got the fingerprint here for compound two. So electronically, they're very different. Structurally, they look very similar. We're also lucky to work with Annette Henriksen and Mikkel Geihil at the University of Copenhagen, and they were able to crystallize a very nice substrate complex of the enzyme. This is ferulic acid. This is one of the basic monomer units that the enzyme will use to polymerize to make crosslinks in the plant cell wall. And from that, you can even deduce a putative mechanism. I won't bore you with that really very much, except to say that really substrates essentially transfer a proton to a water and eventually to a histidine, and the electron goes in at the heme edge. I won't really worry you with that at all. So what is it that really makes a peroxidase and an oxygenase an oxygenase? What is it that makes the difference between those two things? Well, if you take the structure, if you take a horseradish peroxidase, and imagine it's a sort of boiled egg, and you chop the top off, and then you look down from the top, you'd see the yolk, wouldn't you? Well, this is doing the same thing to the protein, looking down on the yolk, which in this case, of course, is the heme group. And if you ask the computer to roll a water molecule across the surface of the protein, you can demark the solvent-accessible surface of the protein. And you can see that water and solvent molecules could enter this cavity, but they can't go any further than the edge of the heme. So in effect, the protein confines all access to the edge of the heme, which means that it can only do simple, straightforward electron abstraction from an aromatic nucleus. It can't do any more serious chemistry than that. It's an example of negative catalysis. The protein is imposing a constraint on the catalytic potential of the cofactor and the ion. If you let it, it could do more. It could do oxygenase activity. It could do all sorts of other things. But the protein doesn't allow it. It limits it to a narrow subset, if you like, of the chemical reactivity potential of the prosthetic group. Just to illustrate, in fact, that you can now, knowing that, you can actually manipulate the properties of this peroxidase. You want to slow it down? You can put a big bulky group here to try and limit the rate at which substrates get in. If you want to speed it up, you can try and make the cavity a little bit bigger. And this is just a set of data from Gareth Williams, who completed his PhD in 98, in which he showed quite conclusively here that if you just change the size of the residue at this position here, you have a tremendous effect on the enzyme. You can essentially block the cavity. It's only 1% active. You can open the cavity up, and it becomes more active, twice as active almost, with respect to bulkier, bigger substrates. If you really want to, you can unpick the catalytic cycle and figure out which bit of the cycle is now better, or which bit of the cycle is now worse. And so what Gareth did was to look at the kinetics of the reduction of the rate-limiting step, the slowest step in the catalytic cycle. And he's shown here that what normally should have been a straight line now is a pronounced curve. And what seems to have happened is that the mutation, the bulky mutation, has introduced a rate-limiting electron transfer step into the reaction, slowed it down, and there's now, if you like, an extra bottleneck, which is the rate at which electrons can get from the substrate to the heme edge, because they're now further away. The substrate simply can't get in, and it's much further away. You can prove that by showing that the substrate doesn't actually bind. You can measure the dissociation constant, the affinity between the substrate and the enzyme. And in this case, you can show that for both mutants, the fast mutant and the wild type are fairly similar, but the Q mutant hardly binds at all. That binding is difficult to detect. You can't do it by simple techniques, and this is where Nigel came in. He helped Gareth and Nigel Brissett determine the binding interaction using proton NMR, watching a resonance on the heme edge that is sensitive to binding. So the chemical shift is an indication of formation of complex, and you can see both the wild type and the fast mutant bind the substrate very well. You don't get any perturbation or interaction at all with the blocked mutant. So controlling the rate at which a peroxidase goes is all about controlling what goes on at that heme edge. What else can you do? Well, can we understand the other aspects of chemical control? In other words, could we convert this humble peroxidase into something that could do this, something that could actually do something that an oxygenase does, i.e. insert the oxygen atom into the substrate as opposed to just throwing the oxygen away in water? Well, there is a strategy to do that, and you might ask, well, why is it important to do that? Well, it's important because many other enzymes in life use this same intermediate, and they do oxygenase activity, the P450s that I talked about earlier, medically very important. Over 120 genes in the human genome for P450s. Can we learn something about the way that P450s work from studying this model system? And interestingly, horseradish peroxidase won't do any of this chemistry. It will not sulfoxidize. It will not insert an oxygen into this thioanosyl molecule, this aromatic sulfide. It will not epoxidate this styrene molecule, nor will it epoxidate butadiene like this. It will just about convert iodine into the halide, into hyperiodate over here. Just about do that. Just about small enough for this to go into the heme cavity, get right next to the oxygen, and get oxidized by oxygen transfer. So can we tamper with this enzyme to make it do these things? Well, if we're going to, we need a bit of a model. And one of the models that was available is this enzyme over here. This is the active site of an enzyme called chloroperoxidase. That comes from a fungus where it does some fairly special chemistry. It uses hydrogen peroxide to oxidize a very wide range of aromatic compounds. And the difference between chloroperoxidase and horseradish peroxidase is that this cavity is quite open. This one is not. It's got this histidine residue here that plays a key role in the acid-base mechanism, an arginine over here, and this big bulky phenylalanine residue. You can't get substrates into this. They just won't fit. So clearly the protein is able to partition the oxidizing power either towards oxygenase chemistry up here or towards peroxidase chemistry down here, starting with the same intermediate. It's like a branch point. It can go one of two ways depending on what the protein allows. So can we make appropriate changes to make this enzyme more like this one? Well, you'll notice that this enzyme not only has this open cavity, but it has a glutamate side chain over here. That's an acidic side chain that, in principle, might be able to take over some of the properties of this histidine residue that plays the role of the base in the peroxidase active site. And this reacts with peroxide very well. It doesn't have a distal histidine, but it does have a sort of surrogate over here. So what we did was to play around with the structure of these residues. We tried to introduce a glutamate residue to provide a surrogate base at this position, and then we introduced a histidine either here or here to try and help the glutamate in its acid-base chemistry. And sure enough, when you got the combination right, the enzyme actually was quite a good peroxidase. So in other words, having first knocked out the ability to form the first intermediate, these are low numbers, we restore it by placing a surrogate base in the appropriate place, we can actually speed the enzyme back up again. So we found an alternative solution, if you like, to that chemistry that's required to form that first intermediate down here. And hopefully we've now done that in a way that leaves the cavity more open. And sure enough, these mutants can now do this chemistry. Wild type can't. Two mutations, more open cavity, and yes, we're now starting to get significant epoxidation catalysis, something that a peroxidase shouldn't be able to do. And the reason, this is the crystal structure of that double mutant solved by Gunnar Berglund while he was on a short visit to Sussex. And this is the wild-type residue in wild-type structure in red here. And you can see the glutamate here is pulled up and out of the active site. It's hydrogen bonding to this asparagine residue. There's the surrogate histidine in the active site just there. But the cavity should be completely open over here. And sure enough, if we do the same sort of experiment and look for the available space, this is the wild type, just a little narrow finger of space down across the iron. This is the way that peroxide molecules and water get in and out. And in this mutant, we've got a nice big cavity alongside the edge of the heme here, extending across ring C. So in principle, there's a lot more space in there now for substrates to get close to the iron, to engage in what a chemist would call octene chemistry or oxygen transfer chemistry. That wasn't really enough. We tried to go one step further. So this time, we retained the glutamate at this position because it seemed to be our best bet so far, and we tried to move the histidine from one of these two positions to up here. Because as long as that base is available and can enhance the basicity of this glutamate, then in principle we should get the same thing. We should get the same effect. And if we can empty the active site completely, we might get even better oxygenation or oxygen transfer chemistry. And so Emil Nagoo started work on this and completed his PhD in, I think, 2003. And what Emil showed is that, yes, if two of these mutants in particular, I'm just going to call them nicknames for sake of ease, this one called AAE and this one called AAEH, were extremely good sulfoxidation catalysts. But more importantly, where there was the opportunity for chiral selectivity, where you could produce one of two optical isomers, in other words, these are mirror image molecules, and in principle you can oxidize this to this or to this. Chemically they're almost identical, but in fact they're non-superimposable mirror images. They are enantiomers. And what's very interesting in biology is that quite often biology needs that kind of specificity. It needs to be able to produce one enantiomer only and not the other one. So if you have an engineered heme cavity in the enzyme, can you get that kind of specificity? And Emil was able to show that in this mutant, it really did make only the R enantiomer, almost 100% pure racemic resolution. So that was quite important. By playing around with the active site, we could tell that this acidic residue at the 42 position was key for that. Without that, it didn't work. That was absolutely key for presumably keeping the substrate orientated in exactly the right way. Emil also went on to show that some of these mutants had a rather unusual property as well. They had a different electronic profile, a different absorption spectra. So here's the mutant in black, and here's mutant is rather odd. You'll just have to take my word for it. Its absorption profile is very different to that of the wild type. And it tells you something. It tells you that the heme cavity is open. Is not open. It tells you that there's something, some kind of ligand, sitting in this position. It tells you that there's a strong field ligand in this position. And since this electronic effect occurred only in mutants that had a histidine at the N70 position, it was likely to be that histidine. Not completely conclusively, but likely to be that histidine. And so, because you've got that cavity has got that strong field ligand in it, it exhibits an electronic property called low spin. All the d orbitals of the metal are all lined up together in an anti-parallel way. So the system is said to be low spin. But if you add a substrate, so here we add either 2-methylthionaphthalene or thioanosol to that resting enzyme, the low spin form converts to a high spin form. In other words, the ligand that was sitting above the iron is pushed out of the way. In being pushed out of the way, the iron is free, its energy levels are no longer compressed, the d orbitals expand and become high spin. And that's shown quite nicely by this electronic absorption spectra. So this low spin to high spin transition is also seen in P450 enzymes, not usually seen in a peroxidase. So again, it's reminiscent of P450 type behavior, oxygenase behavior. You can interrogate those absorption changes in a rather complex way to tell you how many substrates are binding and how tightly they're binding. And interestingly, the two best mutants have two binding sites. There appear to be two substrate molecules that are involved in binding, one very high affinity binding site and one lower affinity binding site. So somehow, there's something interesting going on there. And in fact, you can unpick that further by doing some functional analysis, by doing some enzyme kinetics. And you can show that kinetically, there are also two binding sites. One lower affinity, one higher affinity over here. So two binding sites and another slightly strange phenomena. This is the best variant, AAE. This was the best sulfoxidizer, the best epoxidizer. And it shows a rather strange kinetic profile. It goes up, and you'd expect normally this to go up and saturate over here somewhere, a sort of conventional saturation-type kinetics, but it doesn't. It goes up, and then it comes crashing down again the more substrate you put in. Enzymologists call that, often refer to that as substrate inhibition. And that substrate inhibition actually has very interesting implications for this enzyme. I'm going to try and demonstrate what the cause of substrate inhibition is, and this is where I come unstuck and may fall apart. I'm going to need Tom and Ben to give me a hand with this. And you've got to imagine that this enzyme is doing its best to catalyze sulfoxidation here at something like 1 or 2 per second. So if I throw this to Tom and he throws it back to me, that's the substrate coming in and out of the enzyme, getting faster and faster until he knocks my head off. And you've got to imagine that's going on quite nicely. But as we put in more substrate, Tom and I are going along quite happily, and then suddenly another substrate arrives, a bit faster than that. If it comes in behind the first one in a narrow active site, the product molecule can't get out. It's stuck behind the first substrate. So as long as the substrate keeps coming in rather fast, the product can't get out. The more substrate you put in, the more the enzyme slows down. Now, of course, it's slightly more complicated than that because there's not just one substrate, there are two. But the second one is the peroxide molecule, which is a lot smaller. So if Tom and I are exchanging the big substrate quite happily, and then he suddenly shows me a peroxide, again, we've got competition, but this is smaller. And in the AAE variant, there doesn't seem to be a problem. The peroxide can get in. It's the big substrate that causes the inhibition. But what happens with the low spin variant, so this mutant here that has the low spin spectrum, in fact, that, if Tom was throwing the peroxide ball to me, that would hardly ever react. This is dead slow, useless enzyme, it's low spin, the sixth coordination position is occupied, there's no way the enzyme can do very much. But if Tom throws me the large ball, that pushes the ligand out of the way. It still remains bound, but now the sixth coordination position is free, and Tom, the peroxide molecule, can get in and out. So the substrate activates the enzyme so that it can react with peroxide. In other words, the low spin mutant is showing a concerted mechanism, one in which events now have a forced order by virtue of the entropy imposed by the enzyme. Sorry, I'll try and say that again. The enzyme is forcing a particular mode of action on the substrate. It will only work if the big substrate binds first, causes the spin state change, makes the sixth coordination position available to the peroxide molecule. So the low spin mutants are really beginning to mimic the activity of a P450. That's exactly what a P450 does. It does not switch on until the substrate's available. The reason it doesn't do that is because it does not want to risk making peroxide. If it binds oxygen, then it must not do so until the big substrate molecule is there, ready to react. Otherwise, there's a risk it will generate peroxide. Anyway, now to on to something a bit more useful. So, peroxidases have a variety of applications in nature. And one of the things we're interested in, and we're working with a large group of European labs, is on something called the bioreactor. It sounds terrible, doesn't it? It's not off the Archers. If any of you are listening to the Archers at the moment, they're having tremendous trouble over some horrible methane-generating plant. It's not that. The idea of a bioreactor is that you put wood or renewable materials in one end, and you get ethanol, vanillin, purified lignin, speciality cellulose out the other end. You might even be able to generate some hydrogen along the way. It's a little bit like an oil refinery, only but an oil refinery for trees. And there is one of these already operating in Sweden. It uses an awful lot of trees. It's not terribly green. But the process isn't very efficient because it's very difficult to break down the wood into its constituent parts. It's got a lot of hemicellulose in there, energy-rich material. You could turn that into hydrogen, into ethanol, But you can't, because it's shrouded and covered in this stuff, lignin. Lignin is this very strong, waterproof biopolymer that essentially gives trees their structural strength. So you need to find a way of degrading that, or at least weakening it, to increase the efficiency of this process. Otherwise, you've got to spend a lot of energy, a lot of chemical bleaching, or ozone bleaching, or something, to destroy that lignin without destroying the cellulose. So we're involved in a part of the project down here called biocatalyst engineering to try and make new enzymes, or at least understand the ones that nature's already developed, so that we can perhaps understand how to apply them a bit better to this process. And these are the what nature has used to do this. This is Phanerichaete chrysosporium, the white woodrock fungus. It's the sort of thing that if you found growing in the loft space of your house, you'd be very worried, because you'd have dry rot in your house. It's able to mineralize wood incredibly quickly. This is another one, Flabia radiata, from Scandinavian temperate forests. This is a very powerful lignin degrader. It can completely mineralize lignin, and a lot of recalcitrant biopollutants like DDT and lindane and things like that as well. But how do these organisms do it? Well, they produce three enzymes, just a battery of three different variants of enzyme. They produce a lignin peroxidase, a manganese peroxidase, and sometimes some copper oxidases as well. These use either oxygen or hydrogen peroxide to catalytically oxidize the lignin units to these rather nasty cation radicals here. These are able to react with oxygen, and that initiates a free radical depolymerization of the lignin, effectively fragments it. The problem is that this is a slow process in nature. It's actually rate limiting in the carbon cycle, which is why so much coal has actually accumulated, because it's actually very difficult to degrade it. It's a very recalcitrant biopolymer. The fungus produces these enzymes and also produces some sort of co-substrates to help things along. And one of these co-substrates is called veratrile alcohol. And it's this methoxy alcohol over here. It has an incredibly high half potential for formation of the oxidized state, for the formation of a cation radical, about 1.4 volts. Very difficult to do. So how does an enzyme oxidize veratrile alcohol with a potential of 1.4 volts, given that it's made of amino acids, which generally can't stand more than about 0.8 of a volt? They will be oxidized or converted to radicals, or the heme-methylene bridges will break when the oxidation potential gets that high. So the answer is, again, that nature has found a way of controlling this chemistry that allows it to work. And it doesn't involve the heme edge, because in this enzyme, the heme edge is already blocked. Don't need to make any mutations to block it. It's blocked. Not much can get in and out of here. You might just get a peroxide molecule in and out, but not much else. And about this time, we began collaborating with an incredibly careful, I nearly said fastidious, but there might be Germans in the audience, extremely careful German crystallographer called Klaus Piontek. And Klaus was solving one of the first lignanase structures, and he noticed something a bit odd. He noticed an extra oxygen within bond distance of this particular tryptophan residue over here. And that shouldn't be there. Another crystallographer would have dismissed that as a water molecule, but not Klaus. It was too close. So he refined his structures very carefully, repeated them, and he was absolutely sure that this carbon atom, the C beta of the tryptophan, was hydroxylated. Now, if you see hydroxylation at a tryptophan residue like that, it indicates some hot radical chemistry going on in that vicinity. It's an indicator of damage, if you like. And about that time, we were producing recombinant lignin peroxidase in E. coli through an artificial refolding process, so it had never actually done any catalysis in anger. And if you crystallize that enzyme, it's the red structure here, you can see there's no C beta, doesn't have it. But if you give that enzyme just a couple of equivalents, one or two molar equivalents of peroxide, it produces the C beta. It covalently modifies itself, again indicating that this area is very electron deficient. The electrons are being sucked out of this tryptophan as a result of the formation of that compound one, that ferrile intermediate there. They're being pulled out of the tryptophan. And here's the proof that the tryptophan is actually important. If you sort of make if you've got the gene available and you can make a mutation, you can show that the ability to oxidize veratrol alcohol is totally dependent on the tryptophan. If you take the tryptophan away, it doesn't work. Other dyes and substrates which interact rather poorly at the heme edge, they still work. So there are two substrate interaction sites, a rather bad one over here for dyes and things like that, and a very specialized one over here that seems to involve only the tryptophan and this veratrol alcohol molecule. What are the characteristics of that tryptophan? Well, you can do a lot of bioinformatics, sequence alignments, you can compare what evolution has done in other enzymes, and it's quite clear there are some common features to all lignanases. They all have a tryptophan, and they all have four conserved negative charges around the tryptophan. So it's a bit like unpeeling an onion. We can start to take away some of those charges and see what the effect is on the functional properties of the enzyme. And Elodie Bentley, who's in the audience, did this as part of her final year project, ably assisted by Wendy. And what we show here is that any one of these charges drops the efficiency. You can think of that as 100 units of enzyme efficiency, if you like. Any one of these charges will drop it quite a lot. One of them doesn't matter at all. But if you take out two, it doesn't work. It needs two negative charges to work. So the mechanism requires essentially two coprotonation sites to stabilize whatever the transition state is that results in the interaction of this molecule with the active enzyme. So it seemed quite obvious then that in order to make a lignanase, you needed the tryptophan and you needed at least two crucial charges, both within hydrogen bonding positions, are crucial elements of that tryptophan nucleus. And in order to test these ideas, we wanted to see whether we could actually make a lignanase, because if you can create an activity, you actually understand a lot more about the structural determinants of that activity than if you simply remove the activity. So for that, we needed an enzyme, a closely related enzyme that wasn't a lignanase. And there was one. There was a commercial enzyme produced by Novozymes called Caprinus cinereus peroxidase, another fungal enzyme. And Novozymes was producing this by the gram per liter, by the bucket load, and selling it for denim bleaching. Would you believe it? The stonewashed look of a pair of denims is down to peroxide and a peroxidase, oxidizing some of the dye on the surface of the cotton to produce that just-so-looked-for effect. But they'd already solved the expression problems, but they wouldn't give us the gene. It was a commercial entity. There was no way they were going to part with the gene for this enzyme. And so we were a bit blocked, really. How could we build our own lignanase or change Caprinus cinereus peroxidase into a lignanase if we didn't have the gene? So Wendy, with a lot of effort and so on, actually synthesized a synthetic gene for the Caprinus cinereus peroxidase. It took over a year and a lot of money, and eventually ended up with very nice protein expression, huge quantities of protein from this synthetic gene. So back to the engineering. Now we have the synthetic gene. All we have to do is introduce a tryptophan in the right place, make space for it by taking out one or two other residues, and adding in the charges, the two charges, in the right place. And interestingly, a third charge is already there. It just happens to be in exactly the right place, almost as though the enzyme had a memory of what it used to do. No, that's speculation. But it's very interesting that part of the structure is exactly right. So we have to take out these two arginine residues, add two glutamates and one glutamate and one aspartate at these positions just here. So we're changing this tryptophan we're putting in the tryptophan in place of this aspartate. We're putting in this aspartate in place of this arginine, this glutamate in place of this arginine. So this is a structurally based alignment, not a sequence based alignment. It's based on the three-dimensional alignment between a lignanase and the Caprinus enzyme. And if you do that, lo and behold, you get a mutant that is actually a reasonable lignin peroxidase. It can actually oxidize veratrol alcohol now. It couldn't before. That's the single tryptophan mutant, not very good. This is the tryptophan mutant with two charges, and it's almost 10% as active as wild-type lignin peroxidase. So you might say, well, 10%, that's not very good. But on the other hand, it couldn't do it at all before. So it suggests that the basic elements of the mechanism are now there. So the question is, so we offered this to Novozymes and said, hey, we've turned your enzyme into a ligninase. You can now, if we develop this further, you might be able to bleach paper with it. You might be able to, could become a key ingredient in the biorefinery. And they said, sorry, the money's run out, not interested. But essentially, I think they're just waiting. They're really just waiting for the patents to come offline. They already have the patents for the expression system, everything else. They don't need to deal with us because they're already so heavily protected that they don't need to interact with us in that way. We're still involved with them in this European network, so they get to see all our results for free anyway. There's a moral there, isn't there, between the interaction between academics and commerce. So there's one last little experiment to show. If this enzyme does form, does use this tryptophan as a sort of hot cofactor for the oxidation of this veratrol alcohol, we should be able to trap a radical on it. Something we tried to do years ago with lignin peroxidase, but we couldn't do it. Every time we tried, the radical had gone. Within 20 milliseconds of making it, the radical had gone. And any amount of special spectroscopy to detect it could not pick up a reproducible amount of that radical. But with this enzyme, it only works 10% as well as the lignin peroxidase. So the radical is less reactive. It stays around longer. It's easier to trap. And so if you resort to a rather specialized form of spectroscopy called EPR, or electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy, what this technique does, it sort of counts unpaired electrons. So if you make an unpaired electron, the spectroscopy can pick it up. The problem is, it's a bit more complicated than that. We've actually got an unpaired electron there anyway. We've got a porphyrin pi radical on the heme when you form compound one. So if we take the enzyme, we mix a little bit of hydrogen peroxide with it, we get this very strange signal here at G equals 2.4, and that's an aromatic or an organic radical. It could be the tryptophan radical, it could be the porphyrin radical that is formed quite naturally when you make compound one. But if we raise the temperature, porphyrin radicals, the relaxation time for the radical changes, and the signal fades away. That's a well-established physical behavior for these kind of radicals. So if you raise the temperature from 4 Kelvin, that's liquid helium temperature, to about 40 Kelvin, you should not see any porphyrin radical at all. The porphyrin radical signal disappears, and in its place, you see this black line here. And that could be a tryptophan radical. Might not be, but it could be. It's an organic radical of some sort. We don't really know whether it's tryptophan. So we can play a little trick. We can take the enzyme, and we can simply allow it to warm up to room temperature and then freeze it again. If we do that, this signal at 40 Kelvin disappears. The signal at 4 Kelvin doesn't. The compound 1 is still there. So if this was radical, it's disappeared just in that time taken to warm it up and cool it down again. A matter of 5-10 seconds in the time to get to 40 Kelvin to room temperature and back again. What we can also do is repeat the experiment. This time we've got peroxide in there, but we also put in a little bit of the substrate, a little bit of veratrol alcohol. And we allow the enzyme to turn over, and we capture another spectrum. And sure enough, if you do exactly the same thing without freezing and thawing, this is gone. There's very little of it left. The veratrol alcohol, because it reacts with the radical, has depleted the radical population. And so the radical signal has gone. If you want final proof, you have to go to a very special machine, increase the magnetic field intensity to the point where you can almost saturate the signal, and then you can tell whether it's tryptophan or not. And you can compare it with model tryptophan compounds, and that's the simulation, and it is. It is a tryptophan radical. So this rather bad enzyme that we thought wasn't very good because it only did 10% as well as the wild type was actually a lovely vehicle for trapping this elusive radical and showing once and for all that a radical was there and that it's effectively having a little bit of veratrol alcohol there would remove it. And therefore, that's evidence because it removes the radical signal but does not remove the porphyrin signal. It shows that the radical reacts with the veratrol alcohol, not the porphyrin. In other words, this is reacting with veratrol alcohol, not this. And that's really the important step, that it shows that the radical reacts very selectively just with the substrate. So you can relax, we're nearly there. Or at least I can relax, we're nearly there. Thank you for bearing with me. So we've shown that the structures of all five peroxidase oxidation states have been determined, and there's a sort of model for dioxygen cleavage that really puts the emphasis back on the electronic changes. And we've shown also that there are strategies for actually controlling the activity of this enzyme. We can turn it into something that has both regio and enantio selectivity, and there's a lot more you could do there. You could actually almost tailor this enzyme to do particular oxidation reactions. And we've also shown that some enzymes, particularly the ones that are producing these very powerful radicals, they have to use a different strategy. They can't do it at the heme edge, because if you generate a powerful radical at the heme edge, all it will do is react with the heme. You've got to do it at a distance, away from the heme, using this alternative mechanism involving the tryptophan radical. And it's since been shown, interestingly, that a tryptophan radical is at the heart of the oxidase reaction as well. So the enzyme that reduces molecular oxygen to water, that has a tryptophan radical in it as well. And that oscillates between the native trip and the tryptophan cation radical, and that oxidation reaction massively shoves the pKa around and is the basis for the proton pumping of that enzyme. So tryptophan assumes a new importance within the amino acid repertoire. It's no longer just a simple amino acid. It is potentially a redox factor, a cofactor. And it's interesting that there's only one transferRNA codon for tryptophan. It really is very important, and genetics seems to have recognized, or evolution seems to have recognized that. So I guess the technological environmental challenges that we face now could, in some ways, we could approach them by asking how has biology coped with these things in the past, not just in the present. Life has got 4 billion more years experience than us, and it's seen and solved some of these problems that we face, rising carbon dioxide levels, inability to stimulate photosynthesis to regress the balance. Life has come across this problem before somewhere. And I suppose the last plug would be that you can't separate chemistry and biology. It's a marriage made in heaven, not hell. They are a continuum. When you put these disciplines into very separate boxes, you miss out on a lot of new developments and a lot of new understanding. But you have to have the disciplines in the first place in order to do that. So every lecture, we're told, now has to finish with a quiz, because it's part of your formative or non-formative assessment. And so let's see if we have any takers for these questions. Why do chemists call helium, curium, and barium the medical elements? Any takers for that one? Because if you can't helium or curium, you barium. What is the nature, or what is the name of the molecule CH2O? Seawater. That's not so good, is it? And this is another chemical joke. If a mole of moles were digging a mole of holes, what would you see? A mole of molasses? What did a French biochemist do with his twins? He baptized one and used the other as a control. And finally, a biological joke. What's the fastest way to determine the sex of a chromosome? You might guess this one. Nearly pull down its genes. So there are a lot of people to thank. This has been almost a sort of tour of bits and pieces from 10 years, and there have been a very large number of people involved. In the past at Sussex, Dr. Florence Schneider, a very excellent young French postdoc, Simon Jennings, my first PhD student, Emil Nagoo, Chris White, Jeremy Cohen, who's now gone on to a very posh job at Unilever that earns far more money than I do, Dr. Nigel Brissett, who's still with us in the audience working in the Genome Center. Jeremy's on there twice. I don't know how you manage that. And, of course, present, I wouldn't survive without Wendy, who essentially runs the lab in my increasingly itinerant absence. Maria, whose work I haven't spoken anything about today because it's on molybdenum enzyme, and I just thought that might be too much. Sarah Pannell, who's in the audience, I haven't mentioned any of her work either. That's simply because one can't fit everything in. Kasim Kali, who's in the audience and has done some very nice work on creating covalent modifications within proteins. In other words, how to use this chemistry to put in extra staples or bonds within the protein. Elodie Bentley has been with us now a year and is carrying on with the synthetic lignin peroxidase. And Usufong Friday is with us as well. He's exploring some of these manganese peroxidases that I also mentioned are potentially lignin-lytic enzymes. We've benefited over the years from a lot of European collaborations. Annabella Ivanovich at Paris for her help with EPR. University of Copenhagen and Uppsala for various episodes of crystallography, particularly Janos Haidu for the work on crystal intermediates. Dr. Klaus Piontek, now at Freiburg, he used to be at ETH, for the crystallography of lignin peroxidase. And he, in fact, has just crystallized the structure of the synthetic SIP variant only last week. And the University of Florence, we've had extensive spectroscopic collaborations with them over the years. And last but by no means least, Nigel, who's shown a lot of patience with helping us with this, his favorite technique, NMR, the use of NMR on paramagnetic proteins, and his even greater patience with me for not writing up papers quickly enough, which has become an increasing problem, I have to confess. We've had a lot of support in the past from BBSRC, not so much recently, some from Unilever, a little bit from the Wellcome Trust, more on molybdenum proteins, but more recently some commercial support from Ortho Clinical Diagnostics. They were interested in new HRPs, new immunodiagnostic enzymes, and epitope fusions with these. Unilever was interested in dye oxidation, how to stop dyes moving from red socks to white T-shirts in the washing machine using peroxidases. But our biggest supporter at the moment is the EU Framework 5 BioRenew project. This is an incredibly big project. Its budget is in excess of 11 million euros. There are 26 labs, including 5 companies involved in this project. And twice a year, we meet up and have what I can only describe as a linguistically challenging experience. But it's great fun. Those meetings are very good fun. So with that, I thank you for listening, and I apologize if I bored you or gone on too long. Thank you very much.